Kipps by H.G. Wells, dramatized by Micheline Wander, music by Ilona Sekac, with Mark Straker as Kipps, Nigel Anthony as Masterman, Michael Jenner as Sid, and Paul Dameron as H.G. Wells, the storyteller. Episode 4, Kipps finds the course of true love a little muddy.
Since Arthur Kipps came into a fortune, he has become more refined day by day, more carefully dressed, less clumsy in the uses of social life. We have seen the gulf widening between himself and his former associates in the drapery emporium in Folkestone. We have seen him become engaged to Miss Helen Walsingham, a refined lady teacher of woodcarving. We have also seen a certain reluctance in him to tell his uncle and aunt about the said engagement. However, he is now about to set out on his bicycle, as a newly accomplished cyclist, to go to New Romney in Kent and break the glad tidings to his only living relatives. I must say that as someone who likes things neat and tidy, I cannot help but be relieved that Kipps is about to set his life in order. My name, by the way, is H.G. Wells, and I am, as Kipps would say, a norther, and Kipps is by way of being something of a protégé of mine. As he neared the scenes of his childhood, he turned suddenly, he didn't know why, into the lane beside the old church where once years ago he had sworn to love Anne Pornick. His mind swimming with memories, he saw in front the figure of a woman walking along the lane. There was something bright and familiar about her.
I say, excuse me, aren't you... Yes, Anne, it's Anne Pornick.
Artie Kipps, riding a bicycle. You taking your holidays?
Well, sort of.
I've got my holidays. I'm in service here in New Romney now. It's nearer me mother.
You going for a walk?
Yeah. Look, I picked these flowers. Don't they smell nice?
Oh, yes. Can I walk with you?
If you like.
It's a long time since I've seen you. 7 or 8 years, maybe.
Oh, it don't do to count. Here, you got a moustache.
Oh, yes, I've had it for years now. Almost part of me, you might say.
Coming back here reminds me of being a kid again.
Not half. Here, remember when I left to get apprenticed to a draper? And that's sixpence.
I cut a sixpence in half and we took half each. You still remember that?
Oh, yes.
I still got mine. Funny, isn't it? You still got yours?
Rather. I haven't looked at it for a bit.
Oh, I didn't think you'd keep yours. I thought often it was silly to keep mine. It didn't mean anything. All that stuff about lovers' tokens.
Oh, it was childish, childish.
Didn't mean anything, really. You still in the drapery business?
Actually, I'm living in Folkestone, in an house now. Oh. Hasn't Sid told you?
No, I haven't seen him for a while.
Oh, I ran into him down here a week or so ago.
He's gone. Got his own shop.
He told me.
And he's married. With a little boy.
So he said.
It was fine and grand to have 1,200 a year, thought Kipps. It was fine to go about on trains and omnibuses. It was fine to order this and that and not to have to do any work. And it was fine to be engaged to a girl distantly related to the Earl of Beaupré, as Helen Walsingham was. But yet there had been a zest in the old time out here. A rare zest in the holidays, in sunlight, on the beach and in the high street, that was somehow absent from all these new riches.
Well, I'd best take these flowers into me mum. That's her cottage just there, back of the church.
Yes, right. You gone in then?
I suppose so. You come often to New Romney?
Oh, right over to see me uncle and aunt now and again.
Well, I'm glad to see you.
All of the first emotions of his adolescence came back to him. It was Anne, more than ever. She stood breathing close to him, with her soft-looking lips a little apart, and gladness in her eye. He would have liked to have had a long talk with her, to have gone for a walk with her or something, to draw near to her in some conceivable way, but something told him that it would never do.
Anne?
Yes?
Awful glad I've seen you. Brings back old times.
Doesn't it?
Well, goodbye then.
Goodbye, Artie.
So preoccupied by this encounter, indeed, Kipps might have said he was all in a whirl. So taken up was he with this extraordinary impulse which roared in neglected parts of his being, that Kipps completely forgot the purpose of his visit, to tell his aunt and uncle about his engagement to Helen, and set off back to Folkestone. Was as pretty as he remembered her. Her blue eyes still dark, her cheeks with a quick, high colour. She looked soft and warm and welcoming.
Where have you put that half sixpence, Kipps?
Oh, hello, Mr. Wells. I put in a little packet of paper with some red sealing wax. It'll be in my escritoire.
Don't you think you should have told Anne about your engagement?
Oh, I suppose so. One day I'll have to go back to New Romney and tell her, that's all.
As he rode, Kipps came upon the idea that there was a considerable amount of incompatibility between the existence of one who was practically a gentleman and the existence of one who was a servant, such as Anne. Then he thought of Anne the bright, the desirable, the welcoming, and the first idea vanished. That evening, Kipps spent a convivial couple of hours in his study, in the company of two men of the world, Helen Walsingham's brother Henry and Chitterlow, the playwright, both of whom chanced to call on him at the same time.
But, Mr. Walsingham, sir, I assure you there's thousands of pounds to be made from the theatre, if you back the right horse, eh, Kipps? As an actor and a playwright, I assure you...
But I assure you, Mr. Chitterlow, that if you understand financial politics, there's hundreds of pounds to be made on the stock market, eh, Kipps?
I expect so.
But there's no art. No art, no passion. Speculation corrupts society.
Rot! Speculation is the lifeblood of a society. It is as necessary as the company of beautiful women.
Ah, well now, talking of women is quite another thing. Perhaps you have never known the inner realities of women, Mr. Walsingham, being a businessman and not an artiste. But let me tell you, I have run away with girls. I have been run away with by girls. I have loved and lost. I have loved and refrained. Now that chap Kipling, he put it proper. You know that poem, Kipps?
Kipling? Is he something to do with me? Name like Kipling? It's a bit like Kipps. You must admit.
I don't know, old chap. Could be. Could be that you have not only money in your family, but art and poetry, too.
Oh.
Let me quote the poem to you, shall I?
Oh, do. Do, my dear fellow.
I've taken my fun where I found it. I've rogued and I've ranged in my time. I've had my picking of sweethearts, and four of the lot was prime.
Prime? Sounds a bit like beef.
That, my dear Kipps, is poetry. I'd like to have written that. I really would. Indeed, without at all boasting, I do think that some of my more poetic dialogue approaches the delicacy of Kipling.
But why should someone write a poem about beef?
Mind you, and you needn't let this go any further. I've been perfectly faithful to Muriel since I married her. I have learned all about women from her.
Oh.
Obviously, a man must know about women. And the only sound way of learning is the experimental method.
Talking of the experimental method, have I ever told you about the time I was on a steamboat going up the Hudson?
Kipps went to bed, his brain whirling with words and whiskey, musing on the temptations being put in his way. Real, healthy, strong-souled men should be, I suppose, impervious to such conversations, but I have never claimed a place for Kipps at such a high level. I am forced to admit that nothing can save him from condemnation, for within 2 days he was back in New Romney talking to Anne again.
It's just like old times, isn't it?
Oh, it is, really. Shall we sit down?
All right. I say, Anne, I've got that half sixpence still.
Have you?
Yes, I found it. You know, I've thought about you a lot over these years.
I thought of you a lot, Artie. I met people here and there, boys, men. But I never met anyone like you.
It's jolly our meeting again. Hey, look at that ship out there. I bet I could throw a stone to reach it. There.
Oh, not nearly. That ship is miles away, Artie.
Oh, do another two. Oh, hang on, I dropped a stone on your hand. Did I hurt you?
No, not at all. It's only a little stone.
Let me see.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
It's nothing, honest.
You've got a nice hand.
Here we go.
It's funny us meeting again.
Yes, it is.
He realised that he had never kissed Anne in his life. He looked up, and there were her lips.
Anne?
Yes?
I'd like to kiss you.
And I'd like to kiss you, Artie. Oh.
And they kissed one another. Kisses frank and tender as a child's. Oh. Oh, dear, Kipps. Making love on a beach to one girl when you're engaged to another. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
They're not girls, Mr. Wells. They're Anne and Helen. I love Helen. I revere Helen. But, Mr. Wells, there's something about Anne that's possible. Oh, I don't know. Anyhow, you shouldn't go where it's private. Leave us alone now.
Very well. It was curious that, in retrospect, Kipps did not find nearly the satisfaction in this infidelity which he imagined was there. There was something in Anne's quietly friendly eyes, in her frank smile, in the pressure of her hand. There was something undefended and welcoming that imparted a flavour to the business upon which he had not counted.
I've thought of you a lot, Artie.
Kipps' existence became an affair of dissolving and recurring moods. When he thought of the day when Helen said she cared for him, profound, vague, beautiful emotions flooded his being.
I hold you very dear, Arthur.
But when he thought of paying calls with her, he found himself rebelliously composing fierce and pungent insults couched in the vernacular. Anne, whom he had seen so much less of, was a simpler memory. And yet he had this much clear in his mind, that to have gone to see Anne a second time, to have implied that she had been in possession of his thoughts through all this interval, and above all, to have kissed her, was shabby and wrong. Consequently, some days later, he got up late and cut his chin while shaving.
Oh, dash and bother and dash it!
He kicked a slipper into his sponge bath.
Oh, drat and drab it!
And he scalded his tongue with hot coffee.
I shall never drink coffee again!
And then he had to call on Helen to discuss some impending social arrangements.
I say, Arthur, we have been invited to call on Mrs. Bindon Botting on Thursday. She's having an anagram party.
A what?
It's a party where...
I don't think I want to go.
Arthur, you must avail yourself of the social occasions which are on offer.
No, I don't like calling, Helen.
Well, you must overcome these silly objections.
Why can't I just stay at home?
Out of the question.
Anyway, what's one of the homies an anagram party?
An anagram is a word spelt the same way as another, only with the letters differently arranged.
I've got enough trouble with ordinary spelling without another kind.
For example, S P I K P.
S P I K P? What's that mean?
Those are the letters of your name, but arranged differently.
Oh, I see. Is that all? It's not being able to spell, but not minding that you can't spell.
Well, sort of. And then the T.
I know what a T is.
Everyone at the T has an anagram pinned onto their clothes, and you have to go around and guess what they are. It's lovely fun. Shakes everybody up together. No time for shyness.
Oh, no.
I shall write to Mrs. Bindon Botting and tell her that we accept with the greatest of pleasure.
Tell me again what an anagram is.
An anagram is a word spelt the same way as another, only with the letters differently arranged.
Differently arranged.
As well as worrying about anagrams and the impending tea, Kipps was also concerned the next morning by the contents of two letters. The first was from Chitterlow.
My dear old Mitty Kipps, I have some marvellous news for you. I have decided to let you be the chief participator in the syndicate which is to put my play on. Your contribution will be £2,000, and you will make a fortune.
£2,000?
His old friend Chitterlow, who was both actor and playwright, was effusively communicative about the play, which, truth to tell, Kipps had forgotten.
It's the pestered butterfly I'm talking of. You know that play which I told you about, and I've had this simply marvellous idea. You remember the scene of a man with a live beetle down his neck, the scene I cut. I decided to put it back.
Oh.
Fill the thing out, give it body, wit and depth. Brilliant, eh? And it's thanks to your £2,000 that it's all possible.
Oh.
Your friend Harry Chitlow.
Kipps remembered an earlier conversation with Helen.
Promise me you won't do anything without consulting me, Arthur.
Oh.
The second letter was from his aunt.
My dear nephew, we are considerably took aback by the news we've heard from gossip about your engagement, but we're disposed to hope for the best if the young lady is a relation to the Earl of Beaupré. Well and good, but take care you're not imposed upon. Your uncle waited on the old Earl once in service, and he was remarkably close with his tips and suffered with corns. But tomorrow is our closing day, so we shall shut up shop and come and visit you and say how do you do to the young lady and give her a bit of a kiss if we think her suitable. Your affectionate Aunt Molly and your uncle, Edward George Kipps.
Coming over here today? Oh, Lord. I want to go to New Romney and kiss Anne again. What am I going to do, Mr. Wells? It's too late to telegraph and stop her.
How about a little holiday? London, perhaps?
Yes, that's it. London, brilliant.
Thank you.
Right, I'd better look sharp. I haven't much time. Cool. London.
Had been to London once or twice before with young Henry Walsingham. They had lunch together, and young Walsingham had taken Kipps into no less than 9 hansom cabs, so that he was no longer afraid of these vehicles. He knew that wherever you were, as soon as you were lost, you just called...
Cabby!
Oh!
Royal Grand Hotel, please.
Righto, sir.
The Walsinghams had taken him to theatres, to picture galleries, and to a restaurant where Henry Walsingham had quite brilliantly ordered a lunch, item by item, to the waiter's evident respect and sympathy.
You stopping in London long?
Just for a little holiday. Look around. Look sharp, I want me lunch. Haven't had anything since breakfast.
There in the jiffy, sir. Get up!
Kipps booked into an apartment at 14 shillings a night, and then went down to the dining room. But the sight of a number of waiters and tables with remarkable complications of knives and glasses seized him with terror, and he backed out.
Kipps, where are you going?
To a restaurant. I've been in a restaurant once with young Walsingham.
Hey, slow up a bit. I can't walk as fast as you.
Oh, sorry. But I'll find a place to suit me. I don't want to go in a place and look a fool. Some of these places rot you dreadful, as well as making fun of you.
Yeah, look. A window full of chops, tomatoes and lettuces.
Yeah, that looks good. No, this is the sort of place where you buy things raw and cook it at home. You should know that, Mr. Wells.
Well, here. Champagne bottles in the window. A dish of asparagus. Menu for a 2-shilling lunch.
Yeah, that's such a... Wait a mo. What are them waiters doing? They're staring at me. No fear, I'm off.
I can smell hot food. Look here, Fleet Street. How about this tavern?
Oh, not half. I could do with a pie. Now then, which door do I go in? This one? No. This one? Oh, dash it. I could find myself in the wrong part of the place entirely.
Yeah, you could pretend to be foreign and not know English.
That's stupid. Here, look at them sausage and that grill in that window.
Oh, lovely.
Just like Auntie makes. I'll go in there. Here. I can't. I'm far too dressed up to go in there and eat sausages and mash. I can't do anything right. I'll never eat again. Oh, darn it.
And at that moment of real despair, the only person Kipps knew in London appeared, as the only person one does know in London will do, and slapped him on the shoulder.
Why, Archie Kipps. Fancy seeing you here.
Sid Pornick, brother of Anne. Boyhood friend turned bicycle manufacturer. He looked grave and important, and he wore a silk hat, which gave a commercial touch to his otherwise socialistic costume.
Well, well, well. Sid Pornick.
What a turn-up, eh? What are you doing in London?
Just up for a bit of a change.
Yeah, this is a stroke of luck. I've only come up here to buy a second-hand enamel stove. I'm going to enamel all me bicycles myself. Yeah. You must come and see me little shop.
Well, fact is, I was just looking around to get a bit of lunch.
We call it dinner at this time of day. You won't get anything decent to eat hereabouts. Tell you what, If you ain't too haughty to do a bit of slamming, you could come and join us and welcome.
Could I really?
Well, there's some mutton on the go for me, and it won't take long. Besides, there's someone I want you to meet. Come, we'll go on the Underground Railway. Bet you've never been on that.
Oh. Noisy, ain't it?
Quick, though.
Now, who's this you want me to meet?
Well, there's me wife, of course, and the Nipper. And then there's this chap, Masterman. He occupies our first floor front room. We let it, see. Not so much for gain as for company.
What is he, this Masterman?
Well, probably he's a journalist, but latterly he's been too ill to do very much. He writes poetry and all sorts. He knows all sorts of things. He's been a dentist and a qualified chemist.
What, he can give you pills and things?
No, not that sort of chemist. The serious kind. He's taught himself French and German.
Oh.
We met him at our sociological get-togethers. He'll do big things someday, if he gets better.
Perhaps he won't want to talk to me.
Oh, of course he will. He'll talk to anyone. Once he gets going, you won't be able to get a word in edgeways. You know the kind of man I mean.
Oh, yes. Of course I do.
Sid's shop was stocked with the most remarkable collection of bicycles and pieces of bicycles that Kipps had ever beheld.
My hiring stock.
Wow.
And here's the machine at the most democratic price in London, the Red Flag. Built by me.
Oh, it's very nice.
Isn't it lovely? And I've got a store of accessories over here. I'll be going in for motors a bit.
Did you say mutton?
Motors, I'll say. The mutton department is here, just behind this curtain. Fanny!
Yes, my love?
Fanny, come in here and see who I run into. My old friend, Art Kipps.
Why, Mr. Kipps, I've heard all about you. Sid was only talking about you the other day.
How do you do, Mrs. Sid?
Oh, you can call me Fanny.
And how's the dinner going, then? Art here is famished.
Be ready in two ticks. You have some beer while I get it.
All right, oh, glass of beer, Kipps?
Oh, don't mind if I do.
And look who's just woken up from his nap.
Da-da, my little offspring. Come here, then. Art, this here is Walt Whitman Pornick. Named, you know, after an important writer fella.
Really?
Walt, this is Kipps. Go on, say it. Kipps.
Yeah, that's ever so clever.
Only a year and a half. He's a regular one for words. You can't say a word, but he's onto it.
Onto it.
Come on, come and sit down, then.
All right. Dinner.
Is that enough potatoes for you, Artie?
Another one. We don't stand on ceremony here.
Oh, Fanny, that's lovely.
Oh, good. What do you think of our little home, then?
Nice. Very nice.
Fanny here is somewhat my senior in years, ain't you, my dear?
Oh, only by a year or so.
Should have thought there's any difference. You seem such a match.
He's stuck to you, haven't you, Walt?
More bread, Artie.
I like this room. It's a good room.
Oh, it's only our kitchen.
I like it, though.
And have some more stew, Artie. And when we've done, we'll go upstairs and have our coffee with Masterman.
Masterman.
Any sense of superior fortune had long vanished from Kipps' mind, and he found himself looking at his host and hostess with enormous respect. Really, Sid was a wonderful chap, carving his own mutton, and Mrs. Sid so kind and bright and hearty, and the child. It needed the sense of his fortune at the back of his mind to keep Kipps from feeling abject. He resolved he'd buy young Walt something tremendous in toys at the very first opportunity.
You know, Masterman used to speak at meetings.
What sort of meetings?
Oh, this meeting and that meeting. Not that I heard him mind, but since he's been living here, it's like having our own special meeting all to ourselves.
Well, you'll see.
After what seemed to Kipps like the feast of feasts, never had he thought mutton stew could taste so good, Kipps and Sid mounted the stairs behind the shop to take coffee with Mr. Masterman. Mr. Masterman was a man of 40 or more, with curious hollows at the side of his forehead. His eyes were very bright, and there was a spot of red in his cheeks. His teeth were darkened ruins. He held out a thin, wristed hand and fixed Kipps with a burning gaze.
So, you're the chap with 1,200 a year.
That's right.
And how does it feel to have 1,200 a year?
Ram. Juice ram.
Well, it's not a feeling I'm familiar with.
Well, it takes a bit of getting into, I could tell you that.
And has it made you perfectly happy?
Oh, I wouldn't exactly say that. It made me happy at first.
But then you got used to it?
Yes, that's it. After about a week, I got used to it.
You know, Sid, that's what discourages me from amassing wealth. It doesn't last. The euphoria, I mean. I've always suspected that, and it's interesting to get it confirmed.
I do see what you mean, Mr. Masterman.
You got to marry Mr. Kipps?
I am, actually.
Lady?
Oh, yes. Her name's Ellen.
Of a rather superior social position?
Rather relative to the Earl of Beaupré.
I doubt. If any pain or loss of money does, as things are at present, make more than the slightest difference in one's happiness. It ought to, for if money was what it ought to be, the token given for service, one ought to get an increase in power and happiness for every pound one got.
Don't you have the gift of the gab?
But the plain fact is, Mr. Kipps, that the times are out of joint.
Oh.
And money, like everything else, is a deception and a disappointment.
It's nice to have.
Mr. Kipps, when you first got your money, you thought that you might buy just anything you fancied?
A bit that way, yes.
And then you found that you couldn't?
Well, actually, I did get done over a banjo I bought, yes.
There you are.
That's all very well, Masterman, but money is power. You can do all sorts of things with money.
I'm talking of happiness. You can do all sorts of things with a gun and the hammer with Broadway, but nothing. Well, practically nothing that will make you or anyone else happy.
Well, shooting a gun certainly wouldn't make me happy.
You see, the world must be in order before money or property has real value. And this world, I tell you, is hopelessly out of joint. Man is a social animal with a mind that goes round the globe, and a community cannot be happy in one part and unhappy in another.
Oh, I ain't been out of England yet. I plan to go across to Bologna soon, though.
Yeah, well, let me put it another way. People think there is a class or an order somewhere just above them or somewhere just below them or a country or a place somewhere that is really safe and happy. The fact is society is one body and is either well or ill.
Oh, I did hear that you wasn't too well.
Society is fractious, feverish, gouty. That's my position. And I'm so satisfied of it that I sit here and wait for my end quite calmly. Sure that I can't better things by bothering. I'm not even greedy anymore. My egotism's at the bottom of a pond with a philosophical brick round its neck.
Oh, bravo, Masterman.
Mr. Kipps, you've had the opportunity of sampling two grains of society. Now, do you find the new people happier than the old?
No, I don't think so.
No. There you are, then. No one is quite sure where they stand. All the old tradition has gone and there's no one to make a new tradition. Where are your nobles now?
This is the sociological coming out.
I've made some tea cakes. Oh, anyone like some?
Yes.
Hey, Izzy, you take little Walt and give him his cake. There we are.
If the world is sick, what are we to do?
Well, we've got to make it better. A piece of cake.
Oh, yes. She's an optimist. Frankly, I think that this civilization of ours is on the topple.
There's socialism.
But there's no imagination to make the use of it.
Then we've got to make an imagination.
That's a tea cake, Artie.
Tough. I've never rightly got to the end of this socialism. Hey, what's it going to do, Ron?
Ah, well, now.
Today the world is ruled by rich men. Now, they may do almost anything they like with the world, and what are they doing? Laying it waste.
Yeah.
They own machinery. God gives them a power, like a motor car, and all they do with it is to go careering around the roads in a goggled mess killing children.
I ain't never killed no children, honest.
I am, of course, speaking in the abstract.
Oh, I don't mind.
The rich people grudge us our schools. They grudge the mass of men a gleam of light and air. They cheat us and then they seek to forget us.
That's not yours.
There's no rule.
It's the Masterman.
There's no guidance, only accidents and happy flukes.
I don't quite get it.
The trouble is that the rich people have no heart or imagination. They have knowledge and powers beyond all previous dreaming. And what are they doing with them? Poverty is increasing. You can see it all around you. It isn't as though they had anything to show for the ways they make it.
Here, steady on.
Have some more coffee, Mr. Masterman.
Look at me. What have I had? I found myself at 13, being forced into a factory like a rabbit into a chloroform box. 13! When the children are still babies. But even a child of that age could see what it meant, that hell of a factory. Monotony and toil and contempt and dishonour. And then death. So I fought, got out at last, somehow. Some of us get out by luck, some by cunning, and crawl into the grass, exhausted and crippled, to die. That's a poor man's success, Kipps. And most of us don't get out at all.
How did you get out, then?
I worked all day and studied half the night. And here I am. With the common consequence. Beaten.
Oh, but surely...
You know, they've stopped all the university scholarships at 19 for fear of men like me. And by the time I'd learnt something, the doors were closed. I thought knowledge would unlock the doors. I fought for knowledge as other men have fought for bread. I've starved for knowledge. And now I'm no use to myself or the world.
But it's never too late.
It is for me.
My turn,
Mum. Look now, Masterman. Walt wants to give you a bit of cake.
There now.
I don't know about you, said poor Nick. Whenever you talk about socialism, you get Mr. Masterman all upset. Now, drink up your coffee and let's change the subject.
bicycles, for example.
Bike.
Bye-bye. Oh,
you're going to get a bike.
Poor old Masterman. Bit off his head, poor chap.
What are you going to do now, Kipps, in the face of such prophecies?
Do? Well, I'm in a cab going back to the Royal Grand Hotel.
Hmm. And what about Sid's sister, Anne? I hear she's got a position in Folkestone.
What?
I mean, what if you meet her?
Oh, I wish I'd never kissed Anne.
I mean, what if you meet her when you're out with Helen?
I don't want to think about that. I'll have to write to Helen, just to tell her I've come up to London for a day or so.
That would be the correct thing to do.
She'll want explanations.
Look at that gentleman and lady walking past. They're swells, aren't they?
Well, it's easy for them. They were brought up to dress well and do the right thing from dawn.
I expect that when you and Helen are married and living in your West End flat, you'll parade around much like that couple there.
I suppose so. Oh, I do find Helen hard to understand.
There will be calls, dinners, teas.
Anagram teas, I suppose. I'll have to write to Helen and explain why I wasn't at that anagram tea. Dinners are pretty terrible things, but they ain't...
Aren't
nothing when it comes to teas. Oh, Lord. Look, suppose Anne comes to Folkestone, and I do run into her when I'm with Helen.
That's just as well you're coming to live in London, isn't it?
Yes.
You'll be quite close to Chitterlow in London, too.
Oh, confound an Anne Chitterlow, persuading me to spend money taking a share in his play. He won't leave me and my money alone.
Ah, you should have consulted Helen before you invested.
Yes, well, still, there is Sid. Sid's in London as well.
So he is. And Sid is Anne's brother.
Yes, he is. And Anne... Oh, blow. Just blow it all.
And it is vulgarly imagined that to have money is to have no troubles at all. On his return to the Royal Grand Hotel, Kipps found that he had forgotten the number of his room, and he drifted about the hall thinking that all the porters and officials in gold lace caps must be watching him. Finally, he found a kindly-looking personage in bottle green, who helped him look up his name in the register and find his room. Kipps tipped him half a crown.
Oh, thank goodness for that. Oh, me feet. Now then, I suppose I'll have to change for dinner. Mr. Wells, what shall I wear?
Your dress suit, I think. What about shoes?
Oh, I can't wear me boots. Oh, no, I'll wear them purple cloth slippers with the golden marigolds on them. I'll take me hat down with me, just in case.
When Kipps went downstairs, there were a number of people already seated in the dining room at little tables lit with red electric shaded candles. There were gentlemen in evening dress and ladies with dazzling and astonishing necks. Kipps had never seen evening dress in full vigour before. There was a band playing soft music in a decorated recess. As Kipps entered the dining room, he was quite sure that the entire band turned and looked collectively at the purple slippers.
May I help you, sir?
Oh, I'll come down to eat.
Certainly, sir. Come this way.
Kipps followed the waiter to a table in a corner, looking resolutely ahead of him so as to avoid the eyes of his fellow guests.
Would sir like to see the menu?
Yes, thank you. Well, there's a lot on it. I know. I'll have some clear soup, please.
Certainly, sir. And to follow?
Who's following me? Oh, I see. Look here, you just serve me what's good. I'll leave it to you.
Very well, sir. The wine card?
Yes. And no, I'll have some whiskey, if you please. Old Methuselah freestyles.
Would sir not prefer a claret? Number 23 on the card?
Oh, yes. Now you mention it, that's the ticket. I'll have some of that claret. A bottle.
Yes, sir.
Just look at that, Mr. Wells. Proper scorches. Just a bit of black velvet over the shoulders. I've never seen anything like it.
Your soup, sir.
Oh.
And your claret.
Ta. Oh. Oh,
Don't think much of this soup, Mr. Wells. Doesn't taste of nothing. Why are them ladies looking at me?
Don't look round so conspicuously.
I don't fancy no more of this. Waiter, you can take this away and bring me next course.
Certainly, sir. The vol-au-vent.
Oh, this is more like it.
You know which knife and fork to use for it?
Of course I do. These ones here.
The lady in pink is using a different implement.
Oh.
The lady in pink is just using her fork.
Oh, right.
Kipps, you've just put your knife straight on the tablecloth.
What's wrong with that?
It's covered in cream sauce. Never mind. Take your fork.
Right. Oh, I've dropped it.
A clean fork for you, sir. No, it's all right. I'll pick it up. Fine. I'll take it, sir. Thank you so much.
Oh, I hate that lady in pink.
You're doing fine. Oh, that looks delicious. Makes my mouth water. No, Gibbs, it's far too large for one mouthful. Oh, dear. All over your nice, clean shirt front.
Dash it!
Hey, Gibbs.
Waiter, you can come and clear the slot away.
Yes, sir.
And pour me another glass of claret.
Certainly, sir.
It's better.
Would sir like the main course now?
What is it?
Mutton. With peas, sir.
Peas? No fear. I know all about peas. Sir would not care for no peas, no fear.
Would sir like dessert, then?
Yes. I'll have some of that.
Right away, sir.
Mr. Wells, all this business and all these people staring at me has suddenly made me into a socialist. How can you eat dinner in peace with all these people staring? I've a good mind to ask that man what he's looking at.
Your dessert, sir.
What's this great green thing?
Water ice, sir.
Oh, now you're talking. I'm partial to ice cream. That's good.
Bounce, roll, splodge. Oh, Kipps.
I'll chuck the rest of this rotten thing at all them people in a minute.
I think a dignified withdrawal might be more in order.
Right, I'm off.
And with that, he thrust back his chair, disengaged a purple slipper from his napkin, which had dropped on the floor, and rose. He kicked the napkin under the table, stepped carefully over the prostrate, melting green ice, put his hands deep in his trouser pockets, and marched out. As he left the dining room, anyone who was interested would have observed that for the duration of the meal, Kipps had been sitting on his hat. The next morning, as he came downstairs and looked out into the street, the porter touched his hat. Kipps supposed he wanted a tip and gave him a shilling. When he bought a newspaper, he tipped the boy. When he went up in the lift, he tipped the lift man a sixpence. When he met the chambermaid in the passage, he gave her a half a crown. He resolved to demonstrate his position to the entire establishment in this way. He believed that he was making a flanking movement upon the hotel by buying over its staff. Then, he decided, he would like afternoon tea. The room was large and quiet, and for a short while he felt he was in command. Then other people began to come and sit close to him, a fluffy-haired lady and a clergyman.
No, no, dear vicar, Lady Jane would not like that at all.
But, my dear madam, I'm so familiar with her affliction.
Kipps sat back restfully, and then it occurred to him that his extremely dusty boots were too prominently in the light, so instead he sat up. And then people of the upper and upper-middle classes began to come and group themselves about him and have tea likewise, and so revive the class animosities of the previous day. Suddenly, the room was filled. A great desire to assert himself surged up into Kipps's heart. He felt he would like to cut in on the hubbub of conversation in some dramatic way, a monologue, something in the manner of Masterman. No, he did not have the words.
I don't like this, Mr. Wells.
Distract yourself. Look, what's that over there, that large black lacquered box? I do believe it's some sort of musical box.
Is it?
Yet I believe it takes sixpences.
Yeah, I've got some sixpences in me pocket.
Well, why don't you put a sixpence in the machine and see if you can get a refined little melody out of it?
Right, oh, Mr. Wells. Well, here we go. Well, I never. Hee-hee! Wirroo! Yah! Have at you, all of you. The strenuous, smart lighter. Yah! Stop! Thump, thump, bang! Yah! Thump! Come on, you machine. Show them what you're worth.
What a dreadful young man.
Oh, someone stop that machine.
Yes, of course. I'll say, waiter. I have half a crown here. I wish to pay for me tea.
Yes, sir. Right away, sir.
By the time Kipps took his departure from the hotel, his momentary euphoria had faded, and with a hot face, convulsive gestures, and an embittered heart, he tipped everyone who did not promptly and actively resist, including an absent-minded diamond merchant who was waiting in the hall for his wife. Submission to inexorable fate took him back to Folkestone, Helen, and the dreaded anagram tea. The next day, duly attired in a frock coat, a Panama hat with a black band, grey gloves and brown button boots, he arrived at the dwelling of Mrs. Bindon Botting.
Good afternoon, sir.
Oh, Lord. Payne.
Oh, Kipps.
Payne. Fancy you being Mrs. Bindon Botting's maid.
Anne's eyes met his in amazed inquiry. Something had got dislocated in the world for both of them. He ought to have told her that he was engaged. He ought to have explained things to her. Perhaps, even now, he might be able to drop her a hint.
Who is it, Anne? Oh, Mr. Kipps, how awfully jolly of you to come. Awfully jolly. Come along, in. Run along and get some more tea, Anne. Hurry up now.
Yes, Mum.
It is awfully difficult to get any good men for an anagram tea. We have the vicar and the doctor, and now you make three.
Yes.
Come along in. Helen is here already.
Glad you got back in time.
Take an anagram, Mr. Kipps. Here, I shall pin it to your lapel. Now, you know the rules. It's all frightful fun.
Did you have a lovely time in London?
Yes.
Good. It's been frightfully dull down here.
Anne, dear, bring some more sugar over here for the beer.
Excuse me for a moment.
Arthur, where are you going?
It shan't be a minute.
Excuse me. Anne, some sugar for you, sir.
I ain't got no tea yet.
Well, you're lucky I ain't holding any. Because I'd spill it all over your stupid head. Now, excuse me, I've got work to do.
But Anne, I want to talk to you.
Well, you better be quick then. You won't have much to say, anyhow.
Oh, hang on. Look, Anne. I'm engaged to her. In there. With the red shawl.
Fancy now.
I should have told you before.
Well, it doesn't matter. Because I've heard it from all they've been there. Seems they can't talk of nothing else. Now, please mind out of my way. Oh. It won't do your reputation any good to be seen talking to a servant.
Anne.
Suddenly, everything seemed different. Kipps perceived ugliness all around him. He disliked the whole gathering, collectively and in detail. Here were all these people with money and leisure, with every chance in the world, and all they could do was to crowd like this into a couple of rooms and jabber nonsense about anagrams. He made a decision.
I ain't stopping here a minute longer. I'm off.
The very next morning, a small package arrived, addressed to Arthur Kipps, Esquire. Kipps was informed that it had been left by a young woman, a very ordinary young woman. Kipps opened the package.
Oh, Lord.
The package contained half a sixpence. Anne's half of the sixpence, which in their childhood they had cut in half and divided between them. There was no note, nothing, just the sixpence. That afternoon, Helen called to see Kipps.
You haven't forgotten that we're to dine with Mrs. Bindon Botting tonight.
But we only seen her yesterday.
Arthur, what is wrong with you? Is your digestion upset?
I don't want to go.
The acceptance of an invitation is, in the eyes of everyone, a binding obligation. Which only ill health, family bereavement, or some other all-important reason can justify its being set on one side, or otherwise evaded.
I don't like society, Helen.
But you must see people, Arthur.
Yes, but it's the sort of people you see.
You have to see all sorts of people if you want to see the world. Arthur, dear, I shouldn't ask you to go to these affairs if I didn't think it good for you.
I suppose not. But I'm just a bit grouchy.
Well, you'll find the benefit of it when we get to London. You have to learn to swim in a tank before you go out into the sea, after all. The people here are good enough to learn from. They're stiff and rather silly and dreadfully narrow and not an idea in a dozen of them. But it really doesn't matter at all. You'll soon get savoir faire.
I'm sure I want it.
Well, I'm glad that's all sorted out. And I have a surprise for you.
What?
I have a new evening dress. My brother bought it for me. It's in the latest fashion. Off the shoulder. Very daring, I think. Far too sophisticated for this dull little corner, but I'm going to wear it tonight. For you. And there is a special guest, Mr. Sidney Revel, who is something in the literary world, I do believe. Oh, buck up, Arthur. Mm-hmm. It will be great fun.
During Mrs. Bindon Botting's dinner, the left-hand side of Kipps' braces behaved in a mildly insurgent fashion. He had inadvertently fastened it to the buckle on the right-hand side of the front of his trousers, so that it was placed obliquely, rather in the manner of an official decoration, athwart his spotless front. In addition, he did not know how to look at Helen's arms and shoulders. They were of a type by no means despicable, but he could not look directly at them, however much he tried. She was beautiful, no doubt about that, but perhaps too beautiful. Perhaps too good.
Miss Walsingham, I've been dying to compliment you on your dress since dinner began.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Revel. Will you be honouring us with your presence here for long?
I'm on my way to Paris, so I fear for only another day.
Oh, no.
Mr. Sidney Revel, author of that brilliant romance, Red Hearts Are Beating, was neither brilliantly handsome, nor curly, nor long-haired. His personal appearance suggested armchairs rather than the equestrian exercises and amorous toyings and passionate intensities of his literary masterpiece. He was inclined to be fat, with muddy-coloured, straight hair. He might have been esteemed a little undistinguished-looking were it not for his beeswaxed moustache, which came amidst his features with a pleasing note of incongruity.
It was so very kind of Sidney to come to dinner at all.
Yes. Well, my aunt could spare me for one evening, and how could I resist the chance to remake the acquaintanceship of the lovely Helen Walsingham?
Mr. Wells?
Yes, Gibbs?
What's going on here?
A dinner party?
No, what do I mean that?
Ah, you're thinking perhaps that once Helen was a beautiful dream, a thing of romance, an unsubstantiated mystery.
That's just it.
Have you been in London yet, Mr. Revel?
And now the last thin wreath of glamour is dispelled, and now that she is so near to you, she's actually further away from you than ever.
You may have hit on something.
London, my dear, is absolute chaos. We're leaving our house in the Boltons and taking a little place at Wimbledon. It'll be far more convenient in so many ways.
My husband and I will be in London very soon. When we are married, that is. You must come and stay on your way through next time. Any time.
Oh, how charming of you. My wife is furiously addicted to golf and exercises of all sorts. I, on the other hand, like to sit about in clubs. I haven't the necessary strength for these hygienic exercise procedures. I do hope you will have better fortune with servants than we have had, Miss Walsingham. No one can imagine the demoralization of the domestics of West London during the last 3 years.
It is the same everywhere, Mr. Revel, I assure you.
Yes, very possibly it is. A friend of mine calls it the servile tradition in decay.
Well, your friend might well be talking about my own experience of my last two cooks. And do you know, only a week after I hired her, I am in trouble again with the servant.
Oh, really?
Not the recent girl. Yes, I have done everything reasonable, but my housemaid has given in her notice. Can you believe it?
Why on earth has she done that?
She has been gripped in the throes of some very mysterious grief. Everything as merry as a marriage bell until my anagram tea yesterday.
Oh, that was quite delightful, Mrs. Botting. I cannot wait until you organise another, truly. Mr. Revel, you must be sure to be here for the next anagram tea.
Anyway, in the evening she was very offhand, rather pale, I thought, a little tearful, but really on the verge of being rather disrespectful to me. I had asked her for the second time to bring me up my cocoa, and she answered me very curtly.
Really?
Whereupon I gave her a word or so, and then immediately floods of tears
And she handed in her notice.
Oh, what on earth could have caused it?
Well, for a moment, I thought that the anagrams had somehow offended the good domestic's moral code. You never can tell with maids. But no, she would not say, and she must go, she must leave Folkestone, and that is all there is to it.
Yes, yes, one perceives in these disorders, dimly and distantly, the last dying glow of the age of romance. Now, let us suppose, Mrs. Botting, let us merely and hypothetically speculate that it is love.
Most awfully sorry.
Mr. Revel, you have it. It must be love. What else can it be?
Beneath the orderly humdrum of our lives, these romances are going on until at last they burst up and give notice. The passions of the common or house domestic.
More meat, anyone? Mr. Gibbs?
No, thanks. I ain't hungry.
You've hardly eaten a thing, Arthur. I told you your digestion was upset.
No, I'm all right. Oh, well, actually, I've got to go.
Arthur.
I've got something to do. Something I forgot.
Well.
No, please don't bother to see me out. I can open the front door on my own.
Well,
safe. I'm fast with you and everything. Must go. Forgotten. Something at home.
What? Extraordinary young man.
Where are you going?
No, something, Mr. Wells. I've got Anne's half sixpence and my half sixpence here.
Yeah, but what are you going to do?
You'll see.
You were doing very well in there.
Don't talk to me about in there.
But what's wrong?
I've got something to do.
Well, tell me what it is. I've got a right to know.
I told you. You'll see.
Gibbs? Gibbs? Wait for me. Here. Hang on. Behaving as though he's in charge of his own destiny. What about me? Here, Gibbs. Wait for me. I'm coming with you. What are you going to do? You must tell me, Gibbs. What on earth are you going to do?
Daneman played H.G. Wells, Mark Straker, Kipps, and Nigel Anthony, Masterman, in the fourth episode of Kipps by H.G. Wells, which has been dramatised in five episodes by Micheline Wonder. Kipps' aunt, Jane Wenham, Anne, Moya Leslie, Sid, Michael Jenner, Fanny, Teresa Stratfield, Baby Walt, Judy Bennett. Henry, Spencer Banks, Helen, Catherine Herbert, the waiter and Sydney Revel, John Rye, the clergyman, Arnold Diamond, Mrs. Bindon Botting, Maggie McCarthy, and Chitterlow, Nicholas Grace. The music was composed by Ilona Sekaj. Kipps was directed by Martin Jenkins. ¶¶